60s, 70s, a little before my time. When I grew up, it was the time of Dr. J, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, the Great White Hope, then Michael Jordan, Isaiah Thomas, Mark McGuire, all those guys. But Pistol Pete came before all of that. He played basketball at LSU in the 1960s, and then in the NBA, played for the Atlanta Hawks, played for what was then the New Orleans Jazz. When I was growing up, I always wondered why it was the Utah Jazz. You don't think of Utah as being a jazz mecca, but they started out in New Orleans, so it makes more sense. He died of heart problems when he was only 40 years old. But there's a great biography of him that I read a few years ago. He was one of the greatest basketball players really to ever live. At LSU, he led the nation in scoring all 3 years that he played there. He averaged 44.2 points a game for his whole college career. They didn't have a three-point line in those days either. So if you kind of factor that in, he probably would have averaged over 50 points a game for his college career. So 44 is an NCAA record. He's in the NBA Hall of Fame. He was very memorable in part because of the way he looked. He had long, shaggy hair, and he wore these old floppy gray socks always when he played. But he was also really memorable because of how he played. He played kind of ahead of his time. You know, this was the days of pretty boring kind of basketball. But he was always dribbling the ball between his legs, passing behind his back, behind his head. Nobody did those kind of things in college and in the NBA in those days. And so he kind of was one of the beginning of that kind of showtime kind of basketball. He had one move when he was dribbling full speed down the court, he would pass it between his legs on the run. Or he had another kind of a pass that it was a no look, made it seem like he was going to the left, but he flicked his wrist and it went off to the right. I used to make my kids watch his highlight videos on YouTube. You should look it up if you haven't seen that. But as great a success as he was on the court, and as much as he dedicated his whole life to playing basketball, and he did, his father had him practicing 8 hours a day when he was a kid growing up. Pistol Pete, with all of that success that he reached and the accomplishments he had, he was not a happy person. He was not fulfilled. He knew that there was something more to life than what he was getting. He was always searching. He was searching for something, for anything meaningful. He was one of those people who was always chasing dreams but never feeling satisfied. He drank a lot. He dabbled in all kinds of fads like astrology and astronomy and mysticism. He became a vegetarian for a while, was really into that. Then he became a kind of nutrition freak, and he got into UFOs for a while and was really obsessed with maybe people living in other parts of the universe. He had a very complex relationship with his father, who was a basketball coach and had played basketball professionally himself, and his father seemed to have sort of staked the significance of his life on his son's success as a basketball player. During his professional career and after it ended, he retired early because of injury and depression. He was an unhappy, searching, always searching man. People often commented on his sad eyes, his lack of joy on the court. If you look at those old highlights on the internet, you can see that. Sad eyes. Soon after he retired, he contemplated suicide, especially one night as he drove his Porsche 140 miles per hour along the Lake Pontchartrain Bridge outside of New Orleans. But during the night in November 1982, he couldn't sleep, which was normal for him. But on this particular night, he was haunted by visions. He had a vision, which was really a memory, of himself as a boy, blindfolded, dribbling the basketball for his father in his basement. But then he also had this vision of himself, now a grown man, now a father himself, still blindfolded, still dribbling the ball in the basement. And he began to cry. He began to weep. He didn't know how to pray, but he just said, "Please save me, please." He was praying to a God that he didn't know. He was praying to a God that he didn't know was listening. But finally, he actually did hear what to him was an audible voice in response. He heard a voice that said, "Be strong and lift thine heart. Be strong and lift thine heart." And he knew in his heart that was God speaking to him. And so Pete became a follower of Jesus. And from then on, he was as devoted to his faith as he ever had been to any of the other things that he had chased in his life. There is no doubt that his life was totally transformed. He became a kind of lay preacher. He traveled around to churches and basketball clinics and gave his testimony and preached. He became a devoted father, devoted husband. And at last, finally, Pistol Pete had found what he'd been looking for. And he found fulfillment and peace and wholeness and purpose, meaning. Of all the magnificent moves he had ever made on the court, he always said after this that his greatest move was off the court. He said, "I wouldn't trade my relationship with Jesus Christ for anything in the world." He was in California leading a Christian family retreat when he died suddenly at age 40. He had some sort of rare heart problem. So for most of his life, until the very end, Pete Maravich was looking for something. And he finally found that what he'd been looking for had been around for a long, long time. It had been around all along. But appearances are deceiving. When he had it all, when he was at the top of his game, he was a haunted, unhappy, self-destructive, miserable person. When he lost almost everything, when he was at the bottom, he became fulfilled, full of peace, wholeness, contentment. Appearances are deceiving. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are those who are persecuted. Most of us don't really know what to do exactly with the Beatitudes. We're very familiar with them. These words that I've read now twice, we know these words pretty well. If we have any background at all in church, we're familiar with these words. We may not have heard a lot of sermons on them, especially not a sermon on all of them at once like this. But a lot of us have heard them for so long that they've kind of lost their shock value for us. You know, when you hear something over and over again, you get used to it, and it just becomes a thing you can hardly hear anymore, right? They just sound sort of sweet and familiar to us, like an old hymn that we've maybe grew up with, something that we might write in calligraphy and hang over the piano in our house, have printed on dish towels and put them out. Some of us hear those the Beatitudes and right away we start to feel kind of defensive or guilty. We hear them like these new commandments, and we worry that we're not meek enough. I'm not being pure enough. I'm not being persecuted enough. But what I want you to hear today is there are no shoulds or oughts in the Beatitudes. That there are no shouts or shout nots in the Beatitudes. The language of the Beatitudes is not transactional language. Do this and you'll receive this. Do this and you'll receive that. If A, then B. It is not that. It is descriptive language. It's describing who these people are now and describing what the future is going to hold for them. Right? It's just telling it like it is. And this is so important, I think, when we read these words. We've often heard these taught and thought about them as moral exhortations, you know, with the message that if you can accomplish this ideal thing that Jesus is exhorting us to, then you will be given a reward. And so it goes like this: you should be meek. And if you try hard enough, if you can be meek enough, then you will be blessed by inheriting the earth. Or you should show mercy. If you can show enough mercy, then you'll be blessed by receiving mercy from God. That's not how it is. That's not what it's about. The problem with that kind of moralistic take on the Beatitudes is that it makes these impossibly high standards, which then leaves us with a sense of guilt or failure because we cannot achieve what is demanded from us. And so the Beatitudes produce guilt and frustration, which is the very opposite of what they are supposed to confer, which is blessing. These are not commands. These are not, to make a grammatical point, these are not written in the imperative mood. Imperative is command. Do this, do that. They're written in the indicative mood. The indicative is just describing the way things are. The sky is blue is indicative. The Beatitudes are written like that. And it's just telling what is. And that's kind of hard for us, I think. We would like to be told what to do, and then we'll try to do it. Just give me clear instructions. I'll try to do it, and then we'll all be okay. That's kind of the way I think most of us would like to operate. We're doers. Most of us are chasing blessing. We want to know what to do in order to gain more blessing. If you'll just tell us how to get more blessed, we'll try to do that.
Come on.
We study hard. We compete. We work hard. Like Pistol Pete with basketball, we chase what we want. We chase blessing. And we think we can catch it. We think we can earn it. Did you hear on election night a couple weeks ago, some of us were talking about this. I saw just sort of in passing somewhere in all the election returns and all that all around the country that in Florida they voted on whether or not to outlaw greyhound racing. And so they voted in Florida a couple weeks ago to outlaw greyhound racing. And so all of a sudden, no more greyhound racing in the state of Florida. Maybe you've seen these greyhound races, you know, these dogs race around a track chasing that mechanical rabbit that stays out in front of them the whole time. Then they get to the finish line and the rabbit disappears, I guess. So I don't know what they're going to do with all these greyhounds that they had in Florida for the racing. I know that up until now, when the dogs would get too old or injured to keep racing, you know, they had trouble figuring out what to do with them then. They would look for people to adopt them, find homes for them. The other day, Jamie and I were out walking in our neighborhood, and we saw a man walking his greyhound. And I said to the dog, "Are you still racing?" "No, no," the dog said. "I don't race anymore." I said, "Do you miss all the... Do you miss the glitter and the excitement of the track?" "No," he said. "Well, why aren't you racing? Did you get too old?" "No, I still had some race left in me." "Well, what then? Did you not win? Were you not very good?" "Actually, I won over $1 million from my owner." "So what's the matter? Were you mistreated?" "Oh, no, they treated us very well while we were racing." "Did you get crippled, hurt?" "No." "Then why aren't you racing?" Sometimes you have to really push a dog to get good answers out of him. He said, I quit. You quit? Yeah, I quit. Why did you quit? I discovered that what I was chasing was not really a rabbit, and I quit. And he looked up at me and he said, all that running and running and running and running after what looked like what I wanted? And what was I actually chasing all of that time? It wasn't even real. Even if I had caught it, it wouldn't have satisfied my hunger for an hour. Are you ready to quit chasing? All that running and running and running, you'll probably never catch it. And even if you do, so what? You're never going to catch the promises of these Beatitudes. They are promises from God. They are a blessing promised by God to those who already are what they describe. And so the meek, the merciful, the mourning, hear this as a word of encouragement and consolation. That the Beatitudes are God's promises for hurting and humble and hungry people. My dad will be 80 years old next year. He's been through times of searching, chasing in his life. He's been through a few marriages. In his 40s, he left one good career and just started and tried to do something completely different. He heard me tell this story about the Greyhound one time, and it had a big effect on him, and he wrote me a letter after he listened to it online, and he wrote me a letter. And this is what he wrote. He said, as you know, I chased the fake rabbit a lot of years and even caught it several times, only to discover it wasn't real. Your quotes from the Greyhound were really meaningful and valuable. I wish I could have heard your sermon when I was about 42, 43 years old, but looking back, I probably would not have valued it. I had my eyes set so strongly on the rabbit. Finally, I think I've retired from the race, but even today, I find myself hearing the roar of the crowd at the track and think about getting back into the race. But then remember the emptiness I felt at times when I realized that the rabbit was not real. My prayer, he said, is to realize what I hope you know, that the chasing doesn't gain the blessings we all seek. The chasing doesn't gain the blessings that we all seek. We are all chasing a blessing. But it can't be caught. It can only be given and received. You can't achieve it. You can only receive it. Right? Can you receive it? Blessed are you who are poor in spirit. Blessed are you who mourn. Blessed are you who are meek. Blessed are you who hunger and thirst. Blessed are you who are merciful. Blessed are you pure in heart. Blessed are you peacemakers. Blessed are you who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. For yours is the kingdom of heaven. God loves you already. God's got a blessing with your name on it. You just need to get ready.